We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
From Illinois Public Media, this is Focus on WILL Radio and online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Celeste Quinn. Kyle Mabry is our technical director. Today, our monthly discussion about diet and nutrition, an issue we take up on the second Wednesday of the month. This month, our guest is registered dietitian Sarah Jane Bedwell. Sarah Jane Bedwell is a national speaker and media personality. She blogs for Self Magazine. She makes her home in Nashville, where she appears monthly on the CBS TV affiliate, offering viewers tips about food and nutrition. She's known as Nashville's nutrition expert, and you'll find her online at www.nashvillenutritionexpert.com. On a personal note, she loves to cook and to run. She's completed 4 marathons. One of the topics we'll look into this time out on our program about diet and nutrition, food allergies. They're real and they're dangerous, but more of us suspect them than are truly allergic. We'll get the complete picture here this morning on Focus. Of course, as always, listeners, I welcome your questions about and comments about any nutrition topic. Your phone calls and email messages are invited. Here are the phone numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Sarah Jane Bedwell, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. It's so good to be here. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. So I thought we would talk a little bit today about food allergies to begin with. And I'm curious as to how prevalent are they?
Well, they're a lot more prevalent than they used to be. Currently, about 4% of the population has a true food allergy. But we found through studies that allergies have increased about 18% in the past 10 years or so. And we're not sure if the actual allergies have increased or if just the prevalence of the diagnoses has increased.
Yeah, a recent study that was reported on this summer, I believe in June, found that the prevalence and severity of childhood food allergy is greater than we had thought.
Yes, about 1 in 12 children have a food allergy, and usually if they have one food allergy, they will oftentimes have another food allergy as well. Some of the most common in children are milk allergies followed by peanut and shellfish allergies, and it, you know, 40% of those children really do have very severe reactions to these foods.
And what are the challenges then facing families affected by food allergies?
Well, I think, you know, one of the challenges is just really knowing what is in foods. I mean, we eat so many more processed foods than we used to. And so a lot of times those ingredients may appear in foods that you wouldn't think that they would. For instance, milk products being in maybe a baked good or something that you wouldn't normally associate with dairy. And so it's very important to read the label very carefully and know what you're looking for.
So what advice do you have for families trying to put meals on the table that are healthful and safe when one or more family members have an allergy or allergies?
Well, definitely knowing what to look for on the labels, that's so very important. And then also, you know, knowing what your alternatives are so that your family is still going to be getting a lot of nutrition. I think one of the biggest challenges is if you have someone in the family that does have a food allergy, say, to milk, you know, calcium is still an important need for that person and for everyone else in the family, even if milk is not an option. And so consulting with a registered dietitian and finding out how those needs can be met through other foods is very important as well.
Mm. How do you work with families on this issue? How do you help them sort through the issues and come up with a plan that's a good one, that's workable?
Yeah, well, one of the first things that we do is really help to define exactly what the allergy is, and it is important to actually get diagnosed, whether it's you or your children. If you think that you have a food allergy, it's very important to actually get the test and be diagnosed, because there is a difference between allergies and intolerances. Allergies are actually an immune system response to a specific protein in food, whereas intolerances are a digestive system response. And the reactions aren't as severe with intolerances. And studies have shown that with intolerances, people usually can tolerate a small amount of the problem food without any symptoms. And so it's very important to know whether you need to avoid the food altogether, meaning you have a food allergy, or if you have an intolerance where, in many cases, you may still be able to have, you know, small amounts of that food. So the very first thing is make sure you get an accurate, an actual diagnosis. So that's the first thing that I, you know, recommend to families. And then once we know that for sure, we're able to really talk about what to look for on the labels of foods, what foods that they need to avoid, and then what foods that they can replace. And so a lot of times I'll go in and actually go through the pantry and the refrigerator with the family, go through the grocery store with the family, and really, you know, take that hands-on approach in replacing those foods with the allergens with ones that have similar nutritional value that do not have allergens.
Mm. And in terms of time before you kind of catch on and you go, we got this down now, we've got a plan, we know how to make this work, how much time does that take before it really takes hold?
Well, you know, it is definitely, there's definitely a learning curve. You know, it's very motivating when you know that your family member may have a very severe reaction, so you take it a lot more seriously. But definitely, you know, it can take a few weeks to really learn all the ins and outs and not only get rid of the foods with the allergens, but replace them with foods that also are going to provide the nutritional needs.
Hmm. How are allergies diagnosed at this point in time?
Well, it really depends on the allergy, but there's a couple of different ways. Some allergies can be diagnosed through blood tests, and others need to be diagnosed through a skin prick test. And it's really important for people to understand that it's very important to get diagnosed, and it's very important that you get diagnosed before you start cutting the suspected food out of your diet. For instance, with celiac disease, which involves an allergy to gluten foods, gluten-containing foods, if you are not consuming gluten or haven't been consuming gluten recently and you go and have a test for celiac disease, you're not going to get accurate results. So before you start cutting those foods out, you need to go and get tests done so that you're going to get accurate results.
Yeah.
Because the allergen has to be present in order to see a reaction.
Yeah.
Through the test.
Yeah, and I have been reading that many of us think, gosh, I think I might have a food allergy, and we really don't.
Right, and that's why it's so important to get tested, because, you know, there may be another underlying cause that's causing the symptoms that we think is due to a food allergy, and that may be just as serious, if not more serious, and we need to find out what that is. And also, it's very important not to cut out foods from our diet if we don't have to, if there's not a medical reason, because, you know, a lot of these foods do contain, you know, important nutrients, and we don't want to cut them out unless we really need to.
Do you think the general public appreciates the dangers of food allergens?
I think so. I think, though, we have to be careful, because I feel like with the increased awareness about food allergies, which is a wonderful thing, there's also been an increase in kind of the fad to decrease these foods in our diet, even without being diagnosed. For instance, going on a gluten-free diet for weight loss, let's say. And the problem with that is not only does it cut out foods unnecessarily from the diet, but also it really makes it seem less serious for those who really do have a severe reaction to these foods. And so, you know, if we make going gluten-free more of a fad, then the public, say like at restaurants, maybe isn't going to take that as seriously because they think people on gluten-free diets are just, you know, following a diet or a fad versus, you know, many people who have celiac disease who really, you know, have severe reactions mm-hmm. if they do eat gluten. So it's really important that, you know, we take these things seriously and, you know, don't go on a diet without a medical necessary reason or without a diagnosis.
Why do you think we're so drawn to food fads and diet fads?
Well, I think we're all looking for the answer when it comes to health and fitness and weight loss. And we're, you know, it can be very confusing because there's a lot of information out there these days, you know, through the internet and other sources. And some of it's good information, but a lot of it's not. And sometimes it can be difficult to sort through. And when we're looking for the answer, we're willing to try almost anything, you know, to reach the goals that we're after. And, you know, if something sounds like it might be the answer, a lot of times we're willing to try it.
Mm. Are there resources in terms of books or websites, organizations that you go to over and over again that you trust that you would recommend for us?
Yeah, definitely. There are some great resources. One of the best ones is www.foodallergy.org, and that's got a lot of great information, very trustworthy information about food allergies, you know, and it's a great place to go if you think you might have a food allergy or you've just been diagnosed with one or someone in your family has. Also, if you're looking for recipes and cookbooks and more information regarding, you know, making that transition in your home, going to the American Dietetic Association website. They've got a lot of great resources, cookbooks, tips, and that is eatright.org. And then one book that I particularly recommend for people with celiac disease is called Gluten-Free Diet, and it's a comprehensive resource guide by Shelley Case, and she is kind of viewed as the celiac disease expert in the dietetics field. And so that's a great book for someone who's just been diagnosed with celiac disease.
Mm. Are there certain restaurants out there in the world that are more friendly to people with food allergies?
I think so. You know, but it really, I really encourage people to ask how something is prepared, even if it does say, you know, gluten-free on the menu or dairy-free, I would still really ask, you know, the server or the cook how the food is prepared, because even if it says that, if the person who's cooking the food in the restaurant isn't following the directions to a T or maybe is using a pan that they also used to cook something that did contain gluten, for instance, cross-contamination may take place. So it's very important to communicate to the server in the restaurant how severe your food allergy is and how important it is that, you know, none of that get in your food.
Any advice for people who are traveling and have to deal with this?
Yeah, that's always a challenge, I think. You know, again, being very open and letting people know. For instance, if you're flying on a plane, I know that some people are severely allergic to peanuts, so much to the fact that even if they're opened and, you know, the it released into the air, the dust from the peanuts is released into the air, that can cause a severe reaction in some people. And so it's very important that before you even get on the plane that you're letting someone know who works on the plane that, you know, you do have a severe allergy and, you know, you can't even be around peanuts. And for that to be communicated to the other passengers on the plane, because not only, you know, will they avoid passing them out, they also need to let people know that if somebody did bring on nuts, for instance, that they don't get them out and why. Because usually people are very willing to be accommodating if they know why. That's the key, I think, is really being open about, you know, the severity of the situation.
Yeah. I guess that's why I occasionally will enter a restaurant and right on the door they say this restaurant serves and prepares foods containing nuts.
Right, exactly, because, you know, for some people, even if they entered that, you know, restaurant, you know, they could have a severe reaction right there. Because, like I said, food allergies, since it is an immune system response, I mean, you can have symptoms that range from something as, you know, mild as rashes or itchy skin to something as serious as anaphylaxis, you know, and then swelling of the airway to the lungs. So it really can be deadly for many people.
Mm. This is Focus, and this morning we're talking with registered dietitian Sarah Jane Badwell. This is our monthly discussion about diet and nutrition, an issue we take up on the second Wednesday of the month. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this morning. We've been talking about food allergies, but other topics, any kind of nutrition question you might have, join us this morning with a phone call or by email. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Toll free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. And the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. We talked a little bit about the difference between food allergies, true allergies, and insensitivities or intolerances. In the case of the latter, sensitivities or intolerances, and you've got a child that is intolerant of something or sensitive to it, might that child grow out of that?
Yes, yes. Actually, it's very common for children to grow out of it and even to grow out of the actual food allergies. And we're not sure exactly why, but food allergies do seem to be more common in children, but as they age, it's very common for them to grow out of that food allergy. So that's the good news for, you know, families that may have children that are diagnosed with food allergies. It can be very daunting and overwhelming when that diagnosis first happens, but the good news is that many times they do outgrow the allergies and or the intolerances. But on the flip side of that, as we age as adults, a lot of times we do develop intolerances to foods that we may not have had in the past. For instance, a lot of older adults find that they are lactose intolerant because their body doesn't produce as much lactase, which is the enzyme that's used to break down the lactose, the milk sugar, and find that as they get older, they're more intolerant to those foods than they had been in the past. But again, the good news is that really, you know, most people can still have a small portion. You know, having a small glass of milk, you know, 4 to 6 ounces a day probably won't upset, you know, those symptoms. But having a big bowl of ice cream really might upset, you know, your stomach because, again, that food intolerance is usually a gastrointestinal response, digestive system response.
Yeah. Let's take a call from a listener now. This is someone waiting for us in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, this is not about food allergies, but it's related to food. It's about cholesterol.
And okay.
Wondered when somebody has, you know, a high number and they don't have any of the other risk factors, and they eat well and exercise and don't eat meat and all that, if you know of anything besides, you know, all those normal things that somebody can do to both get the good one up and the bad one down, and I will hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay. Sure. Yeah, so that's a great question, and it's something I think a lot of people deal with, and it is important to know that about 30% of what makes up our cholesterol number comes from genetics, but 70% is due to lifestyle, and really, you know, you can make a difference in your cholesterol just by doing some things, changes in your diet, and of course exercise, which exercise is generally the best thing to increase the good cholesterol. And it is important to find out if your cholesterol number, total cholesterol number, is high, what your ratio is of the good cholesterol to the bad cholesterol. Because many times, if your good cholesterol is high and you have a good ratio of the good to the bad, the doctors aren't so worried about the total number. But it is important to find out what your ratio is as well as the total number. And, of course, eating foods that are high in fiber, that's one of the best ways to help lower the bad cholesterol, the LDL, because those foods with fiber bind to the cholesterol when it's in your small intestines where food is generally absorbed and limits it, limits its absorption by the body. Also, one thing that I think is very effective, but a lot of people maybe aren't doing on a daily basis, is adding plant stanols and sterols to the diet. And they basically are plant substances which help to block the absorption of the cholesterol. And they're not the same as fat substitutes or fiber, but they do act very similar to fiber in the term of how they block the absorption. And they're usually found in foods such as vegetable oil spreads that come in tubs, and some orange juices and pastas now contain these ingredients, as well as other baked foods, but you do have to look for them to be listed on the label, and you really need an average of about 2 grams of the plant stanols and sterols a day. And if you're getting that, that can help lower cholesterol by about 5 to 15%. So it really can make a difference. And that can also help even if you're already taking a statin to lower your cholesterol. You can still benefit from adding those plant stanols and sterols to your diet. And then, of course, reducing our consumption of saturated fat, which is the fat that's usually found in our animal-based products and our solid fats that are solid at room temperature. Those are kind of the keys to what is saturated fat, and that tends to raise the cholesterol, so really reducing that in the diet as well.
In terms of labels, in terms of listings of ingredients and whatnot, how are sterols and stanols labeled?
Well, a lot of times you might not necessarily see them in the ingredient list, but if a food contains them, they've been added for a purpose usually, and so they are going to be listed on the side of the package, and it would just say contains X number of grams of plant stanols and sterols.
Okay, and the product might also be labeled may help reduce cholesterol or something like
right,
that.
Right, exactly. The FDA has authorized that health claim for the plant stanols and sterols to reduce the risk of heart disease. So a lot of times, yes, you will see that listed as well.
Hmm. What are your favorite things to recommend for people who are looking for food that is high in fiber?
Oh, definitely, you know, the more fruits and vegetables, the better. Also, whole grains like oatmeal, you know, is kind of one of those gold standard foods. But if you don't like oatmeal, also other whole grains like barley, beans, and lentils also would be good sources of fiber. And, you know, again, like I said, just increasing the fruits and vegetables, that's something that we all need to do more of. And really, you want to shoot from somewhere between 25 and 35 grams of fiber a day. If you're really wanting to make a difference in terms of your heart health.
And what does that look like, 25 to 30 grams?
In terms of food?
Yeah.
Well, that would probably, you probably have at least 5 servings of fruits and vegetables, and in addition to that, have at least 3 or 4 servings of whole grains a day. So you might look at it as having maybe 2 servings of fruit and or vegetables at dinner and 1 serving at your other 2 meals, breakfast and lunch, and 1 for a snack, and then having a good serving of whole grains at each meal as well.
Hmm. What do you think of the new guidelines from the government in terms of what our plate should look like?
Yeah, so the MyPlate guidelines, I was really excited when that came out because I think a plate is much more realistic when it comes to giving us a guide to what our food intake should be versus a pyramid. You know, it's a lot easier to relate to from that aspect. And I was excited about it as well because I have been telling people for years to one of the easiest things that they can do for health and weight loss is to fill half of their plate with fruits and vegetables. And that's exactly, you know, what the MyPlate recommendations show is filling half of it with fruits and vegetables and only about a fourth starch and a fourth protein. Mm-hmm. And usually we get it the other way around. You know, if we go out to eat, we usually have a big portion of protein and a big portion of starch and maybe just a little garnish of vegetables on the side. So it's really kind of rethinking that plate. And the more natural colors occur on your plate, the better you're probably doing in terms of nutrition.
So the more colorful your plate, the better.
Exactly, exactly.
And as I understand it, also you want more vegetables than fruit on the plate.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's one of the reasons for that is because vegetables, especially non-starchy vegetables, tend to be even lower in calories but equally high in nutrients as your fruit. You still want to get the fruit in there. It's still very important as well, but it is a little more calorie dense, and so the vegetables, putting a little more focus on those. So if you're doing a minimum of five a day, you know, three of those being vegetables and two being fruits would be the ideal recommendation.
Yeah.
And really varying the colors and types of vegetables. And I think this is important not only because different colors and different types of vegetables and fruits have different nutrients, but also because I think we tend to get in fruit and vegetable ruts. We eat the same two or three fruits and the same two or three vegetables day after day, and so of course we get tired of eating them. But really there's just hundreds and hundreds of different options when it comes to fruits and vegetables. We just have to kind of think outside the box. And I always tell people maybe take your kids with you to the grocery store and let them pick out a new fruit or vegetable or try to get a different one each time you go, and that helps you get from getting in the rut.
Yeah, I have seen parents do that with their children in the grocery store, and it's a lot of fun to watch them. Let's find new colors. Let's pick some yellow and some red and some green, and the kids are really into it then. It's not like vegetables, yuck. That's fun.
Exactly. That's a great thing to do if you have a picky eater or a child that's resistant to eating fruits and vegetables, is to get them involved of the picking it out and the preparation, because if they have ownership of it, they're much more likely to want to try it than if it's something you just put down in front of them that they've never seen before.
Mm. There in Nashville where you live, Sarah Jane, have you seen an increase in community gardens and community gardening activities that in particular involve children?
Yes, I have. Definitely. I think it's something that's kind of new around here, but I think it's definitely starting to catch on. And not only that, but also being involved with a CSA, a Community Supported Agriculture program. Many families are starting to do that as well, because it's such a great value and great way to try new fruits and vegetables each week that you might not necessarily pick out at the grocery store.
Yeah. And at one of our farmers markets here in the Champaign-Urbana area, the Urbana Farmers Market, they have a program called Sprouts at the Market, and it's aimed at children. And there are a number of activities on a Sprouts Saturday where kids can learn about you know, things that might be new to them,
right,
and engage in some fun activities and get to meet some of the farmers and that kind of thing. So that's actually this coming Saturday here at the Urbana Farmers Market. It's Sprouts Saturday, so check it out.
And I always tell parents as well that even if they've tried to serve a child a specific fruit or vegetable in the past and the child hasn't, you know, really taken to it, don't give up, because it can take 10 or 15 times of just introducing the food before the child will even try it. That's actually a very average number. So I think one of the biggest mistakes is sometimes we just, you know, give up if we've tried two or three times and think, oh, they're just not going to eat it. But a lot of times it's just, you know, reintroducing it until it becomes something more familiar.
This is Focus, and this morning we're talking about diet and nutrition. Our guest is Sarah Jane Badwell. She is a registered dietitian. She's a national speaker and media personality, and she blogs for Self magazine. She makes her home in Nashville, where she appears monthly on television, offering viewers tips about food and nutrition. She's known as Nashville's nutrition expert, and you'll find her online at www.nashvillenutritionexpert.com. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is Focus. More in a moment.
This month, maintenance work is being performed on our AM580 antenna. It'll make our signal more reliable, especially during inclement weather. At times when the work is in progress, we'll need to reduce our power, and some of you may have trouble receiving AM580 as clearly as usual. 90.9 FM will not be affected, and AM580 is always available online at will.illinois.edu. Thanks for understanding.
And we're back with Focus, our guest, Sarah Jane Badwell. Listeners, you can join us this morning with questions about diet and nutrition. Give us a call or join us with an email message. The phone number's in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Excuse me. And our toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. The email address is will-talk@illinois.edu, will-talk@illinois.edu. I'm curious, Sarah Jane, how did you, I mentioned not in this reintroduction, but at the top of the hour, that you've completed 4 marathons. How did you begin running?
Well, I actually began running when I was in junior high school. My parents encouraged me to find an activity that I enjoyed, and I decided to go out for the cross-country team. And so really began running when I first started. I couldn't run very far at all. I could only run a minute, walk a minute, and eventually built up to running 2 miles. That was my first big milestone. I remember doing that and being so proud about that. And then continued to run all through high school and into college competitively on cross-country teams, and just really it became a habit for me and a way to relieve stress and feel good and get exercise, and so it's still something I do. I love it because it's one of those sports that you really don't have to have any equipment for other than a pair of shoes, and you can do it wherever you go. And so I've enjoyed running different places as I've traveled. And so anyway, what the next big feat after getting out of college and being a college athlete was running a marathon, and so I decided that that was my goal, and trained for several months, and then kind of got hooked ever since then. So it's definitely something that takes a lot of training, but it's one of those great things because it's a challenge, and you feel like, you know, the only person you're really competing against is yourself when it comes to a marathon. So it's a really fun thing to work towards.
Yeah. Well, it's really encouraging to hear a marathoner say, when I started, I could walk a minute, run a minute, walk a minute, and that's what all I could do.
So. Exactly. And, you know, it's really, running is really a sport that anybody can do. I mean, you know, maybe not everybody should do marathons. You know, if you have problems with your knees or things like that,
sure.
You know, maybe not. That's not the way to go. But really, it is something that everybody can do, even on a smaller scale, even if it's just running a mile or maybe a 5K. But, you know, anybody can do it. It takes just some time to work up towards that and, you know, really even starting small, like I said, running a minute, walking a minute, and continuing to do that till you can run 2 minutes and walk 1 minute. Just starting small, and exercise makes such a big difference in every aspect of our life, and it really goes hand in hand with healthy eating as well, because I find that myself, as well as most of my clients, once they start exercising, you really crave healthier foods because you're wanting to fuel your body versus just eat. And so it really can be kind of the first step into developing a healthier lifestyle. Mm.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got a couple of listeners who are ready to join us. This is a listener in Champaign on line one. Good morning.
Hello.
Hello there.
Yeah. I grew up in Asia and came here in my 20s. And I see a lot of food allergies here. When I grew up, I never saw anybody have a wheat allergy or nut allergy. How does the U.S. fare compared to other countries in the world in food allergies?
That's a great question. And, you know, I'm not really sure. I haven't seen data that compares the United States to other countries in terms of food allergies, but that would be something very interesting to look at. Like I said, I do know that there has studies have shown there have been an increase in food allergies in the United States over the past 10 years or so, but I don't know what the comparison is to other countries. I know in general the health in the United States, you know, from an obesity and heart disease standpoint, isn't as good as many countries. So it would be interesting to compare the food allergies as well.
And I also have one more question. When I grew up, you know, in a country, we didn't have electricity all the time. So generally people would use the milk, you know, buy the milk the same day and use it up. So generally people would have raw milk, they boil it, and then use it. So here when I came and whenever I started drinking the pasteurized milk, I would always have a intolerance. But when I started boiling the milk and use it, my problem is not there anymore.
Interesting. I have not heard that before. That is very interesting. So you get the raw milk and boil it yourself is what you're saying, and then you don't have
that's what I did. That's what people do in my country back home.
Mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
Here, I buy pasteurized milk and I boil it before I use it. And that doesn't give me any lactose intolerance or any problem. But when I travel, I cannot use milk at all. In fact, when I ended up in hospital, and I couldn't drink milk because of that reason. So I don't know. What would be the explanation?
That's very interesting because I don't think the actual lactose content is any different from raw milk to pasteurized milk. But it would be interesting to look at more research involving that because the only thing that I would think that would make a difference would be the actual lactose content, and I don't think that that is different, but there may be something else involved in that process, you know, that would create a difference. And I do know one of the reasons that we pasteurize milk in this country is because it does many times have to travel for quite a ways and does have the potential to carry bacteria, which can be especially dangerous for young children or older adults. And so I think that's great that when you do get the raw milk, you're boiling it yourself and taking out that risk factor there. But it's definitely, you know, something that can be a risk for certain members of the population.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call this morning. Next, we go and take a call from a listener in Savoy on line two. Hi.
Hi there.
Hi.
I have a question about beans and sweet potatoes and corn, things that are somewhat like vegetables, but do those count as vegetables when you are considering your five servings per day?
Well, that's a great question. Yes, they do, but they are starchy vegetables. And so you don't want to go just with the starchy vegetables. You want to count, usually what I tell people is, even though those are vegetables, they are plant-based sources, in terms of like looking at your plate, like the MyPlate, the government recommendation, I would put those in the starch category. However, you know, what a great thing to be able to kind of double count a food, you know. It's just kind of icing on the cake that you're not only eating your normal servings of vegetables, but also you're making your starch a plant-based vegetable food. So in terms of kind of looking at your plate, especially if you're trying to lose weight, I do like to put those starchy vegetables, as we call them, in the starch category on the plate and fill the other half with the non-starchy vegetables. But at the same time, you are getting the benefits of the fiber and the nutrients from them that you know, that we think about when we think about vegetables.
Okay, great. And I have another question. Is there a difference between, I know that frozen vegetables have more nutrients than canned vegetables. Is there generally a difference between generic brands versus the fancy, you know, name brands as far as nutrients?
For the frozen vegetables?
No, I'm sorry, for the canned vegetables.
For the canned vegetables, usually not. But the best, and in fact, many times the generic brands are packaged in the same manufacturing plant even as the name brands. But the best thing that you can do is compare the labels, specifically compare the ingredient list and the actual nutrition facts panel. And if they're identical, you know, you can feel great about it. If they're not, for instance, maybe your name brand is a no salt added or a lower sodium version, then that might be the case where you would want to go with the name brand. But if they are, you know, if the ingredient lists are identical, in many cases they are going to be identical. And there is one case, or there are some cases in which that the canned vegetables can actually be more nutritious in terms of tomatoes. That's one of the examples. When tomatoes undergo the heating and the canning process, they actually increase in lycopene, which is a powerful antioxidant that helps to prevent certain types of cancers. So, in fact, canned tomatoes, in some senses, are more nutrient-rich than your fresh or your frozen. But most of the time, your fresh or your frozen is the best way to go. And if you do go with canned, try to stick to the no salt added or the lower sodium versions. And another little trick, for instance, getting something like canned beans, which is a great, cheap, healthy option, making sure that you rinse and drain those can reduce the sodium by 40%. And that's one of the biggest downfalls of the canned vegetables is the sodium. So when you get those things like the canned beans, just rinse and drain them and get the no salt added or the lower sodium if possible, and that will help a lot.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call this morning. And we have an email message. Someone is wondering about iceberg lettuce as opposed to darker lettuces. The listener says, I read somewhere you should replace iceberg lettuce in your salad with romaine or other dark lettuce. What's wrong with iceberg?
Well, there's nothing actually wrong with iceberg, but what I call iceberg lettuce is crunchy water because although there's nothing bad about it, there isn't a whole lot of nutrients in it. It's kind of like water. It's basically like a crunchy version of water. So it's a great filler food, very low in calories, very high in water, but it doesn't provide a lot of nutrients. And in general, with all, not just lettuce, but all fruits and vegetables, the darker they are, the more nutrients they have, especially those great antioxidants. And so that's probably why the listener saw that, you know, the recommendation to replace the iceberg with the darker leafy greens like romaine or spinach or arugula, because those are going to be higher in nutrients like iron and antioxidants than, say, your iceberg lettuce. But if you really just love iceberg, try doing a mix of the iceberg with, you know, the romaine or with the spinach, and that way you kind of get the best of both worlds.
Yeah. And at this time of the year, I got to say, though, iceberg lettuce is awfully refreshing.
It is. It is. And, you know, it's important that we are getting plenty of those high-water fruits and vegetables this time of year. Because really, if we're eating a healthy diet, those foods that are high in water can make up almost 20% of our fluid needs for the day. So it's important to make sure that we're getting plenty of those types of foods.
Let's go back to the phones, and we're going to take a call from a listener in Urbana waiting on line 3. Hi.
Yes, I'd like to go back to the use of raw milk in the diet. It's a very risky practice. Prior to the introduction of
pasteurization?
Yeah, pasteurization. It was a principal carrier of both tuberculosis and undulant fever. And it still has potential, although the incidence of both tuberculosis and Bang's disease in cattle is much lower today than it would have been in 1900. But tuberculosis was really very widespread in the first part of the last century and throughout the 1800s. And raw milk was a principal carrier. Raw milk can also potentially carry things like several of the organisms that cause stomach disorders. It's not apt to be in the milk as it comes out of the cow, but it could easily be introduced afterward. And, of course, pasteurization precludes any possibility of this.
Right. I totally agree with you. And
it does not alter the composition of the milk.
Nutritional value, exactly.
Now, there are some other things that I would frown upon in the production of milk today. The use of human growth hormone to enhance the milk production and
sure.
The use of antibiotics. And one might, if they were having problems with milk, want to get milk from a source, pasteurized milk from a source, which does not permit the use of these materials. The other thing I would say is the lady who called in, I think, had an Indian accent. And Europeans have a gene which showed up in our population about 3,000 years ago, which helps with the digestion of lactose. Most children can digest lactose. Most adults throughout the world cannot. We Europeans and some other populations have this mutation, and it does allow us to use milk with greater impunity. But anyway, that's a possibility that that's the real problem, not the raw versus pasteurization. Well, anyway, may I say something else about the salads? The green leaf, loose leaf, and red loose leaf lettuces are excellent sources of vitamins as opposed to the iceberg.
Yeah.
But thank you. I'm enjoying your program.
Okay. Well, thanks for the call this morning.
Yes, very much. And I very much agree with you, and I definitely would not recommend, you know, anyone to not drink pasteurized milk. That is for sure, for sure. That is definitely the safest way to get those nutrients, and you're exactly right. The pasteurization process does not alter the nutritional content, so you can feel good about getting those nutrients in a safe way with the pasteurized milk. Mm.
Let's talk with another listener. This is a listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Yeah, hello. Would you please address this situation of histamine intolerance in food?
Of what intolerance? I'm sorry?
Histamine intolerance?
Histamine intolerance in food, in certain foods.
Hmm.
Well, I'm not sure exactly what you're referring to. Are you talking about, like, oral allergy syndrome?
Allergy with symptoms like headaches and itchiness when certain foods are digested, such as fish or red wine or cheeses, and the histamines do not appear in blood or skin tests, but that apparently has the same reaction, the body has the same reaction as to other histamines.
Okay, yeah, I think what you're referring to is certain amino acids that do occur in foods and can also oftentimes result in migraine headaches for many people.
Mm-hmm.
And although there's not a lot of research on this,
they're very hard to detect.
What's that?
It is apparently very hard to detect.
It is. It is hard to detect. And that is one case where, you know, visiting with your doctor and dietitian and maybe doing an elimination diet,
yeah,
where you actually eliminate one food at a time that you think might be suspected to cause these problems, and then, you know, you'll be able to tell if there's an improvement. But it is very important with those elimination diets to be working with a dietitian and a doctor, and also to only be removing one food at a time, because if you remove several at a time, then you're not going to be able to identify which one really made the improvement if you do see an improvement. Yeah.
Yeah, very complicated.
Mm-hmm. It is. It is. And,
it's another
and we don't know the exact cause of migraines in general, so it is hard to identify that. But many people do see improvement with, you know, changing their diet and taking out some of those typical foods. And a lot of the foods that you mentioned, the red wine, chocolate.
Yeah, chocolate, salami.
Exactly, some of those type foods.
Sauerkraut, nuts, tomatoes sometimes, I think.
Yes.
Spinach.
And again, like I said, very important, you know, to work with a doctor and a dietitian, and like I said, only take one food out at a time so that you can make a good decision about that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the tyramines, I think, that specifically that you were referring to, which is an amino acid chemical in those foods, especially in aged foods.
Aged food, yeah, older cheeses.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's it. That's the typical food group that you'll see that went those in. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And we're going to take one more call, but I have to be very quick. Line 2, Champagne. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a question. You were talking about the blood versus skin test for allergies.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, you said that there are cases when it's better to do the intradermal testing, which I just recently did. My doctor did 54 foods, and I reacted strongly to, or at least moderately, to a lot of them. So I was curious, at this point, I'm now looking for foods that, you know, I can eat to replace some of those for nutrition.
Okay.
And I was wondering, would you recommend a blood test or finding, because 54 was the maximum. So
right, yeah. I mean, definitely the more tests that you can get and the more specific that you can get, the better, because that's really going to allow you to know what foods, like I was saying before, that you totally need to avoid and what foods you may be able to tolerate in small amounts. So certainly, you know, the more specific that you can get with the testing, I would say that will help you in determining those things.
And then perhaps working with a dietitian.
Yes, definitely working with a dietitian is very important, and taking those results with you when you go to see the dietitian, and being able to, you know, work with her on replacing those foods in your diet, and to find a dietitian near you, going to the American Dietetic Association site, eatright.org, there's a section on there where you can actually type in your zip code and find a dietitian near you.
Okay, Sarah Jane, we've got to wrap it up there. Sarah Jane Bedwell, you'll find her online at www.nashvillenutritionexpert.com. Sarah Jane, thank you.
Thank you very much.